So good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. So this is the first class of a series that Katie and I are giving together on kind of a brief introduction into the great Pali Canon. And I'm sure almost everyone knows this, but a canon simply means a collection of works. The English canon would be things like, you know, Shakespeare, Milton, the great poets, etc., etc. And Pali refers to a language, which I'll talk a little bit more about in just a moment. So it's the collection of works that date from about the time of the Buddha from the time of the Buddha, and then for the next, I would say, 350 years or so. According to the Buddhist tradition itself, they're all the words of the Buddha or his disciples. But clearly they've been added on to and altered in various ways throughout time. Now, there are several collections of Buddhist texts, several canons. We talk about the Pali Canon, we talk about there's a Tibetan canon, which includes other texts. There's the Mahayana canon, which includes Chinese texts and other texts. But in fact, there are a number of different collections that have been lost over time. Most people don't know that roughly, but say by the time 300 years after the death of the Buddha, there were at least 18 different schools. We know their names, but we often don't know exactly what teachings they embraced. And this started shortly after the death of the Buddha. Even actually during the time of the Buddha, he found there were disciples, some of his monks, saying things that they didn't really, they had perhaps misunderstood him or were actually giving wrong information, and he would chastise them and say, "No, when did I ever say that? And this is the way it is." And he would kind of put them on the straight and narrow again. And then after the Buddha died, of course, there was the great concern about, well, how do we preserve these teachings? And you may think, well, of course, what you would do is write them all down, or put them on the web, right? And they'd be there forever. However, in India, writing, the act of writing, did not happen until after the death of the Buddha. Sacred texts particularly were always spoken. They were always memorized and then passed on orally from generation to generation. And for those of you who may have been to India or know something about the Hindu tradition, this is still true today. Yes, the sacred texts are written down today, but what's most important is not what's written, it's what's spoken. And so when a Hindu priest will do a certain ceremony, what's really important is that his pronunciation, his enunciation, his rhythms, these are all very powerful acts that need to be conducted in a certain way. So at the time of the Buddha, of course, that was also the case, and for hundreds and hundreds of years before the Buddha, that was the case. Sacred texts were not written down. They were memorized, carefully memorized, and then passed on from generation to generation. Now, I'm not a linguist or a scholar in that way at all, but if I remember correctly, writing, the Sanskrit writing, the kind of writing down of religious texts, didn't start until close to the first century in BCE, before the Common Era. So pretty late, really, to have this kind of stuff written down. So a number of different schools flourished, or kind of Buddhism broke up into a bunch of different schools soon after the death of the Buddha. But please don't think that they were like, you know, a bunch of monks and nuns going off into their own individual corners and muttering about the faults of the others. In fact, they all lived together in the great monasteries and the great universities that sprung up in India after the death of the Buddha. It was really, I think, more like a philosophy department or a literature department, right? You've got the people who are specializing in existential philosophy, and then, you know, the guy over here who's working on Kant, and Hegel's over there, you know, these professors in their offices. But they would still get together and talk with each other and be friendly. And that was also the case with, at least generally, they're friendly. Actually, in my department, at any rate, the ideal was that they hopefully will be friendly. But in India, as I said, they all lived together. They often practiced together. The one difference was that they had different views on, and sometimes they had different texts. And these texts would form their own kind of their own canon, in a sense, writings that they felt were quite connected to the Buddha. And many of them are lost. And today, what we have are kind of one large collection, the Pali Canon, dating from that time, and then the Mahayana Canon, which has parts of this from that time, and then other things added on. In India, there are two sacred languages, Sanskrit, which is kind of the classical sacred language of India, and has been used for chanting and then, of course, later on for writing sacred texts for about 4,000 years. But this language that the Pali canon is collected in originally was a spoken language and spoken in a number of, or at least understood in a number of regions in India. But we don't know if it was really the language the Buddha spoke. Some people, scholars, believe that it was, but we're not sure. But nevertheless, it was obviously a very important language at the time, and many of the teachings of the Buddha were collected in that language and then passed on from generation to generation. So the speculation is that if Pali was not, or the variation at that time was not the language of the Buddha, it was probably pretty close. And today, if we look at some of the Sanskrit language and the Pali language, so many of the words are very similar. In fact, they can be kind of confusing for Westerners. Like, for example, the word karma in Sanskrit is kamma in Pali. Or the word sutra, which means the teachings, is sutta. Or dharma is dhamma. So very close, right? Many of the words are very close. Nirvana, Nibbana. So the Buddha lived probably in the 5th century, around that time, before the Common Era. Is that okay? Everyone understand before the Common Era? Yeah. I check because I teach LCGS at VU, and sometimes I'm using these words, and then like weeks later, a student will come to me and say, "What the heck is BCE?" You know, I've been using that for weeks, and you haven't even. Anyway, and he taught for quite a long time, an unusually long time for a religious figure. When we look at many of the other major religions, you know, they're like Christ and Muhammad and people like that, you know, didn't live for very long or didn't have a chance to teach very long. But the Buddha taught for probably 45 years. So you can imagine quite a collection of teachings that he gave at various times. And these were memorized. People had amazing memories. And some people still do. It's not unusual in Islamic countries, for example, for people to memorize the whole Quran. There are people who are Christians who memorize the whole Bible or all the New Testament. In Jewish tradition, you would memorize all the Jewish Bible. It's not that unusual. Well, today it's really unusual, but in past times, of course, that's how we communicate and remembered things and pass it on to the next generation. I think it was Socrates who thought the invention of writing was terrible, horrible. How it went was, when the Buddha was alive, particularly during the rainy season, they would all live together for about 4 months. The monks would come, he would give teachings, they'd be memorized, often repeated, and then passed on to the other areas of India when the monks would leave and wander around, but then come back and recite, and again kind of memorize. So after the death of the Buddha, this tradition continued, and I won't go into the long story because I think I'm already taking a bit too much time going on and on here. But there were a series of councils where monks would get together regularly and recite, and they would recite these long collections, and they divided it up, which I'll explain in just a moment here. But I do want to mention one person, Ananda, who was one of the main disciples of the Buddha, and his cousin, who had an exceptional memory even for those days, because he would hear things once that the Buddha said and then be able to repeat, apparently. An interesting story, at the first council, Ananda wasn't invited because he was not yet awakened. Wasn't yet awakened, and fortunately, just before the council met, just before it met, he had his aha moment, and then they said, "Oh, good. Now tell us what the Buddha said." So, from what I understand, anthropologists who study this say actually this is a pretty rigorous and good way of passing on information unchanged from generation to generation. And in fact, writing is not, at least how it used to be. Because, you know, you'd get the individual monk in his cell or nun, you know, writing away, and they would go, "I'm sure this person meant this," and just make a little change here or there, or they'd make a slip of the pen. But in this kind of memorizing, it's memorizing in groups, right? So it's passed on from generation to generation with a number of people confirming this is the correct information. So just about 100 years before the Common Era in Sri Lanka, there was a great famine. Many people died, and they were concerned that the Buddhist teachings would be lost. And it was at that point that they started to write down all the teachings. And then from there, that spread into other areas of India and then into other areas of Southeast Asia in order to prevent this possible crisis of the loss of the Buddhist teachings. All of the oral traditions were written down on palm leaves, which did not last very long. And so they had to be recopied fairly quickly. And then these palm leaves were organized into baskets. And those baskets became how the teachings were classified. That's why it's called the Tripitaka, or what's the Pali word? Tipitaka. Tripitaka or Tipitaka. Does that sound familiar? Tripitaka?
Three,
right?
Baskets.
Right, three baskets, right. So the English words, a lot of our English words come from Sanskrit, come from those roots, the Aryan Sanskrit language. So that's why Tripitaka. And what about sutra?
Suture.
So sutra means to sew, and so they would sew these palm leaves together, right, to make a little book. So that will be on the final. Yeah, so, you know, a number of words come from these languages into English. Very interesting. To stumble across them is quite fascinating. So these were organized into baskets. Tipitaka or Tripitaka, and I'll just pass this out. I think I have almost enough for everybody. This is a kind of just diagram that shows how they're organized. And I'll just say a word or two about each of these and then move on. Oh, good. Just enough. So the three baskets, and they're organized into, at least in this translation, called the basket of discourses, which means the teachings of the Buddha that were, and then the basket of discipline, which refers to the rules and regulations that monastics, monks and nuns, should follow. As you can see, major offenses, minor offenses, etc. But it's not quite as dry as that, actually. I was just reading something I'll mention in a moment here. And then the basket of analysis, the Abhidharma. And this is a collection which is kind of looks at kind of an analysis of the Buddha's teachings. So it's unusual. You wouldn't quite think the Buddha would speak like this, but according to the tradition, the Buddha did write the Abhidharma, but it really is a kind of philosophical organizing and analysis of the teachings that we find in the discourses. So, yeah, that'd be good if I could have a watch. Thank you. Most people, of course, are interested in the Sutta Pitaka, or the discourses, because these are the basic teachings. But the Vinaya, the kind of book of discipline, apparently has some really juicy stories in it. One translator I was reading, I haven't read the Vinaya, says there's one famous story of Prince Dighafu, which is a very dramatic story of murder, intrigue, sex, and revenge. So it sounds something that we can look forward to later. The discourses, there's over 10,000 suttas, or small kind of chapters, within this collection. And you can see this collection is divided into five nikaya. The person translated them here, I think, fairly well. The long discourses, the middle-length discourses, the kindred discourses, gradual discourses, which is a collection according to numbers, like the two of this, the three of that, the eight of these, and on it goes. And then the miscellaneous collection, and that number five. And what I like about the number five, or one you may already know, if you look at under the five in that kind of big box, there is the J, the birth stories, or the Jataka tales. These are the tales of the Buddha before he was Buddha, often in the form of an animal doing various things. So they're kind of like, in some ways, reminiscent of Aesop's fables and
Folk tales.
Very interesting and very fun to read. There's the verses of nuns and the verses of monks, and this is a collection of poetry, often very moving, often of enlightenment or awakening experiences. And the one that most people have maybe even heard of is B, the Dhammapada, a collection of verses attributed to the Buddha about practice. And very readable, well, in many, many English translations of that. So, just going back up to the basket of discourses, the number two, the Majjhima discourses, this is that collection. All right. So, and this has, that's notes, well over 1,000 pages of teachings just in this alone. So the whole Pali Canon fills like
a good size bookcase. So if you had all this whole collection together, which of course you can buy if you read Pali. It hasn't been, I don't think there's a complete English translation, but that's what we're looking at. So a large collection of sacred texts dealing with various different aspects. Okay, lots more I could say, but I also want us to have some time to look at a very short sample that I brought. But I wanted to say, lastly, just a few words about why. Why study this stuff, this Pali Canon? What's important about it for us? And in a way, each person, I think, needs to answer that for themselves. If you do find value in reading this kind of material, it's not easy reading. Sometimes it's quite challenging. But it has been read and recited and studied for well over, say, 2,400, 2,300 years. And when something has been read and passed on from generation to generation for that long, probably it has something of value. And it may not be obvious on first reading. Reading this kind of material, as I think, is like reading a challenging poem, perhaps. Maybe you don't get it at the first time you read it. It's not like picking up Harry Potter or Game of Thrones and zipping through it. It's really a matter of, you know, reading something and then rereading it and then rereading it and maybe then rereading it again, you know, over a period of time, thinking about it, perhaps taking notes, and perhaps not understanding the whole thing, but allowing a phrase or two, a passage or two that seems to resonate, and you hold on to that. And by hold on, I mean just, you know, review it, reflect on it, maybe write it down, and see what it has to offer you at this moment, at this time. And certainly, the parts of the canon that I have read are well worth coming back to again and again and again. And looking at different translations. Looking at different translations. It's amazing, the difference. And I brought a sample that we're going to be looking at together, partly to illustrate that. The one thing I want to caution you, and Kate will probably be talking about this next week or at some point, the Buddha said very clearly, very, very clearly, do not believe this. Do not believe this. Don't believe it because I said it. I don't believe it because it's written down. Don't believe it because everyone else believes it. That's not the criteria for accepting something. He said, you know, you have to test it in your own life. Study it, see if it resonates, put it into practice. Does this lead to the lessening of suffering? Does it lead to wholesomeness? And if it doesn't, don't do it. There is nothing absolute about the teachings. The Pali Canon, and indeed all the teachings that we find in all the Buddhist canons, are not revealed teachings. They're not like the Quran or the New Testament or anything like that. They are meant to each of us to kind of taste, digest, and then see whether this really is something that is helpful or not. Does that make sense? So, fortunately, my idea was that we'd work on this in pairs. So I think I made 9 copies. I think I have just enough. Right, so every 2 people could take one of these. And
is that counting me or not counting me?
Let me hang on to one for now, and then I'll. Okay, and then could someone read the next translation?
I am always frightened. My mind is always agitated. whether anything has happened or not happened, if there is not a terrified state, tell me that. Not other than by developing the enlightenment factors and austerities, not other than by the control of the mental faculties, not other than by giving up everything, a not terrified state for living things could be seen.
Hmm. And then the last line for both of them goes something like, hearing that, the deity vanished from there. So what I'd like you to do now, maybe in your groups, I have there kind of like four kind of questions, or at least things to consider. And you might want to respond in other ways, and that'd be fine too. But with your partner, just what is your first impression upon reading these two translations? You know, do they seem very foreign? Do they seem kind of current in some way? Just what is your impression? And then how do you relate to Subrahma and the kind of difficulty that he found himself in? And then the Buddha's antidote. And then, if we have time, what translation seems to resonate for you? Okay? So we'll take maybe 5-6 minutes just in pairs to kind of talk about this and see what it's like for you.
For all of our existential crises.
Okay, thank you. Please just finish off whatever you're saying, and then let's just make a little circle again, kind of come together so we can...
All you divas.
Subrahma.
Is that with a D or an I?
Yeah. Some overlap.
So, thank you for doing that. It seemed that people were kind of engaged. That's great. Let me ask first, how do you relate to the suffering of Subrahma, this deva here?
Oh, it's not deva, it's deva.
It's deva.
I was pronouncing it also as deva. It seemed appropriate.
I think everybody's been anxious.
Everyone's been anxious.
Mm-hmm. Well, I felt it as really just ringing true to a kind of existential angst of the human condition. You know, he put it succinctly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm terrified when I of imaginary fears.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, help.
Yes, help. Get me out of here.
It makes me think I find it more anxiety provoking to realize people I love may die before I do than to think of my own passing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To contemplate life in the absence of people I want to stay here as long as I'm here.
Right, right. It certainly resonates with the story, or at least the commentary on Subrahma here. Yeah. Anyone here free of anxiety? Yeah. What one thing that struck me was, you know, this is at the time of the Buddha. You know, and we're still there. This seems to be part of our human condition, perhaps. You know, we all have to face this, this anxiety. The mind is always agitated about problems, present and future. You could also add past, maybe.
I'm seeing, you know, human condition. You know, but, you know, when I look at our cats, when they're just...
they're not thinking about the future.
Laying there, just so, you know, laid out. When they're not running around being crazy, they just give it up. And they're not worrying about, they're not rehashing what happened yesterday or worrying about the meeting next week. Mm-hmm. You know, that is our human condition, that ability to have foresight and insight. So how do we live with that?
Mm-hmm. How do we live with that?
The cats are plotting how to kill you.
Yes, I remember that.
They are a little devious about getting food.
Yes. Yeah, that's what's interesting about killing us. It's like, how do we get the cat treats?
But that's the double-edged sword of that ability, though, right? Because without it, we would have no any of this. Society, modern science.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Laser printers.
Right.
But it makes it so that we worry about what's going to happen or what has happened.
Yeah. So some kind of energy is arising, right? And how we use it, how we direct it. And then from reading the second verse, what impression do you get of the Buddha's answer? And does it resonate? What's he really saying here? Do you, can you, from reading these two translations?
I think that he's, you know, he's saying basically, you know, you've got to let go, and it's, you know, it's about attachment as being the cause of suffering. But I did find striking how kind of didactic it seems in this statement that, you know, it seems that there is only this is the only way. You have to be awaken and be austere, and you have to restrain your senses or control your mental faculties, and mm-hmm. you have to relinquish all. That's the only way you're going to get safety as a living being, or free, a non-terrified state. And I do kind of question that. I think that it's, compared to like a lot of other Buddhist teachings that I hear, that's written in a very sort of direct and this is how it is. And to me, at least, to think that, you know, you have to restrain your, control your mental faculties is an impossible, you know, that's like a fool's errand almost. It's like, you know, try and control your mind, try and control your thoughts. Your mind is a thought machine. It's like it's an impossibility. So I think, you know, there has to be a level of interpretation there, and maybe this is just, as a teaching, it's kind of putting it out like, bang, here's a kind of a big statement that you're like, whoa, that's kind of heavy, but... yeah, I was a little bit surprised. That was my reaction to
Good. It is very succinct, right? And again, a poem, something that you would fairly easy to memorize. And I would suspect there is commentary or follow-up that would... This is like the Cole's notes of something much larger, would be my guess.
But there is also... I think we will find in the Pali Canon sometimes this... what seems more of a little bit of an absolutist tone, that is modulated when you start getting into the Mahayana sutras, which emphasize the bodhisattva ideal of compassion and meeting the needs of suffering human beings where they are, right here. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting to see that unfold in Buddhist writings.
Any other comments on this?
What's the understanding of the Devi?
Deva?
Vanishing.
Oh, at the end.
Oh, at the end. That means he goes back to his abode. He goes back to where he lives. So he appears at the Buddha, asks his question, gets the answer, and then he returns to heaven-like abode.
We were wondering, well, there's no sense here whether he's satisfied with the answer.
No. No, maybe he's like, get me out of here. Well. But are you satisfied? Are you satisfied with this answer?
Well, it's very practical and therefore not entirely satisfactory.
Yes.
I interpret it, he just says the only safety for all living beings is through wholehearted effort.
And we don't want to hear that, right?
Well, no, it's useful.
Right.
But it's not. It doesn't seem like it, you know, like you get the feeling he's holding something back.
Oh, okay. Mm. I mean, is this a message that we want? Oh, so go ahead.
So I was just saying that, or thinking, sharing with my partner that, so as I've been trying to get better with my practice, I'm realizing it's like a cycle, like this cycle of what Michael Stone talked about, like the boredom, the aversion, I forgot the third one, ignorance, I think it was. and this cycle sort of continues. And then as you improve with your mental faculties, it's like you discover these other fears that come up. And when it comes to relinquishing all, like the only thing that keeps coming to my mind is to really take like a quantum leap, like some sort of physical action. Like you can only, it seems like it's getting to a point where you're like, you're getting to so many you're going from this practice to like now it's becoming almost some kind of manipulations of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's turning back on me, like it could maybe become destructive instead of something healthy, because like you're going through this, I mean, you sit and we practice sort of our listening, getting comfortable with understanding our breath, and of course we can continue that and get better with that, but what Michael, you know, just a lot of things what Michael Stone said, like, okay, there is no enlightenment. And so I'm trying to test that out, like with my own sort of understanding and just trying to improve with just the practice. However, like the one thing that still keeps coming up is to relinquish all, is to like just let go of the comforts, but really letting go, like really, I don't know, creatively coming up with some option as far as, I don't know, like if you're going to go live somewhere, take on a child,
I see, yes.
Take on a certain hobby or something,
mm-hmm.
to allow your practice to kind of manifest into something else, like, you know, where we're not just sitting and listening to our breath. It's like, okay, now we're going to try something. We're going to shift it now. We're going to supplement it with something. So this is what I've been trying to understand.
I think the Buddha would agree. Like, you test it in your own life and just see how it unfolds.
Take a leap. Take some sort of faith. You know, yep. Like now maybe allow faith to kind of bridge you to something else. Mm-hmm. And see where that goes. Mm-hmm.
When I read this, and I think maybe other people have had this similar experience, you know, we have to then, I think, ask, what do we mean by austerity? And what do we mean by to relinquish all, for example? The two words that stood out for me were for the word awakening and to relinquish, to let go. And although this is really short, we don't really understand what the Buddha was actually saying at this point, because there's not a lot of supporting material. But in the other suttas, the other writings, it becomes really clear that relinquishing means to be able to let go of wanting things to go the way I want them to go. I need to let go of what Michael needs, how Michael needs it to be. Does that make sense? So I think what the Buddha is saying here is that you can have desires and, you know, you'll have wants and maybe those will never go away. But can you open the hand and not suffer by, it didn't happen that way. It didn't happen the way I wanted it. And that is the dagger, that's the where the suffering arises.
May I suggest there's an alternative that Krishnamurti would probably say something quite different. Now, Krishnamurti he never said what people wanted him to say. So he probably was not as popular. I mean, he told a couple thousand people, I am no longer your leader. I'm dissolving this organization.
Mm-hmm.
So, or if for that, Jashanti would say the same thing, or Ramakrishna. This whole thing, giving up everything, would be in spiritualism the second death, meaning the death of the self. And that comes from the Majjhimaka as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm a Majjhimaka student, so I see this as saying that the Buddha is saying, you must give up your sense of self. Your sense, your perspective of the world, which the Course in Miracles calls the miracle. You must give up that sense of who you are and your attachment to being
Patrick, your attachment to being Michael. Hmm. And once you do that, then that is that change of perspective, the miracle, or what you call the second death or enlightenment, which is the requirement.
Great. Another way of saying it? Good. The comments?
I kind of read it as there's an element of humor in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because as people who are versed in Buddhist texts and people who practice, we know that it's not as easy as that. It's not like we just need to have, oh, that's how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do it. We kind of practice against the impossibility of doing these things.
Uh-huh.
You know, like how do you be austere? How do you get awake? How do you let go? It's like you can't. And that's kind of the starting point of practice, I think.
Mm, good. Yeah.
Which is a bit like the vows, really. I mean, it's all aspirational because you can't save all beings and you can't, you know, I mean, that's when we're talking about this now, I'm just thinking, I'm just relating to the vows and how mm-hmm. much those are aspirational mm-hmm. and how much this ability to give up or relinquish the self mm-hmm. is an aspiration, but may be really difficult to actually do in practice.
Yes, yes.
They may, you know, just be a little tricky to get to. For most of us. Obviously not for the Buddha, but, you know, for most of us.
Well, pretty hard work.
Yes, he worked very hard, 6 years, so very hard work.
His tree starred himself, and yeah, he set yeah. the tree. And,
yeah.
And yet, at the same time, and this is what you're referring to about Michael Stone's talk about Nirvana, in any moment of full presence with the, you know, our many, many obstacles just drop away in that moment of full presence. That's Nirvana. It's not out there, you know,
mm-hmm.
myriad lifetimes ahead of us. It's right here. It's just that, you know, we haven't practiced to have a kind of stability in our capacity to drop the obstructions. But we practice them. That's why it's practice. So.
And part of the practice is grappling with these texts. And I think what we did tonight is actually probably a good example. It's not like we all are going to come down to like, oh, this is what it means and kind of have it pat. It's more like, what is this saying to me as an individual? Is it, what is it saying, and what does it say to that person? And kind of hearing each other, how we respond and are influenced by this. And maybe this one is not going to be suitable for you. But maybe next week when Kate does something, there'll be something you go, oh yeah, this is my life. I see this in my life. It'll be very clear. And that's one reason to read this stuff, is that we begin to see aspects in our life that we have not yet given language to. And this is just one way to give language to often some hidden or dark or yet unexamined aspect of our life. But I see it's 9 o'clock, and we have some great-looking dessert out there with tea. So please feel free to keep these sheets, and I'll bring in a few more of the poem one if people would like. I'm sorry I didn't bring in enough tonight.